From Hollywood, it's Out of My Mind. I'm Jay Douglas, and in episode 4, we're going from big, scary audiences to little pint-sized audiences to Wuthering Heights. And we'll visit your uncle. Yes, we're flinging ourselves hither and yon to find the essential, non-essential, and curiously essential information that only we baby boomers can appreciate. If you're not a baby boomer, you can become an honorary one by taking a pledge to live until at least 70, all the while pretending that you're still 35. That's all there is to it. Episode 4 of Out of My Mind begins by turning real scary. Congratulations! Your neighbor urged you to run for the condominium board, and you won. Even better, now you have to make a speech.
Fear of public speaking is the number one fear in America. Number 5 is fear of dying.
Peter Desberg is a practicing psychologist. He's also a former psychology professor and an expert on stage fright. You probably don't need to be reminded, but because you can talk to a stranger in a checkout line or work the room at a party, that doesn't mean you can speak in front of an audience.
And the reason is the expectations that are set. It's like you're up there as an expert, you've had time to prepare, so you should be saying something with very high expectations. This should be entertaining, this should be interesting, this should be informative, this should be an expert talking. That puts a lot of pressure on.
Relax. Peter's going to get you through this. Public speaking takes a little practice. Okay, it takes a lot of practice. And you can't weasel your way out of it.
People sometimes say, if I practice something too much, won't it become stale? And the absolute opposite happens. When you're there under pressure trying to remember what happens next and where you go next, it's going to put a lot of pressure on you. If you know everything coming up, you can take advantage of anything that happens in the room. A door slams, a baby cries, it doesn't matter. You're there, you're set. I find it really helpful to have people call you when you know you're going to be practicing, have people walk you by, knock on the door, set your iPhone alarm to go off at random times, just so you're used to hearing it and going on, so you don't get stopped. You want to practice as much under performance conditions as possible. So for instance, some people consider practice, I'll take my talk and I'll read it over. That's not practice. You have to say it. And if you know you're going to be in a room with 20 people, and you're going to have to kind of raise your voice to reach the ones at the end, you don't sit in your bedroom and say, okay, thank you all for being here. You have to practice like this and say, hello, thank you for being here. If you know that you want your notes in front of you on a table, have practice in front of something where you can have your notes and glance down at them. What you want to do is as closely as possible approximate how you're going to be performing.
All the practice in the world won't do any good if you obsess over other people's actions. You can't control whether anyone will even like your talk, let alone whether they'll vote your way in an election or do business with your new company.
But I can control how I prepare. I can control how I practice. I can control how I simulate the situation. So that's all I can do. But that's a lot.
Peter Desberg is a practicing psychologist, a professor emeritus of psychology at California State University, Dominguez Hills, and the author of 4 books on stage fright. I'll put links to his books, plus some additional tips from Peter, in the show notes. Just go to bit.ly/OOMM123 and click on episode 4. Then follow the link to show notes.
We've been to homes of living authors, but we've also been to homes that are like Virginia Woolf, so we can go and visit and see some of the things that inspired her. But we have been able to have maybe a meal with a living author.
As an English major, Mary Whitson loves to read. But the problem with reading is, well, it's reading. The only sights, sounds, and smells you enjoy are the ones you make up yourself. So Mary decided to take a literary tour and see firsthand the places where some of her favorite authors lived, wrote about, and worked.
The original professor for these tours I took was a children's literature professor at the University of Hayward. So she began by taking trips over to England, and you would meet English authors there and get to actually hear them speak and meet them. So it was just right up my alley.
That first tour turned Mary into a literary tour aficionado, and she's covered a lot of ground, bringing a layer of realism to her reading.
I've gone on 11 trips, and I think 5 or 6 of them were to England, Scotland, or Wales, or Ireland. But I've been to Egypt I've been to Poland. I've been to Greece. I've been to Germany. I think that's about it.
I think we can agree that's a fair amount of passport stamps. One of the reasons Mary's so passionate about these tours comes from what USC professor Henry Jenkins calls collective intelligence. It's the idea that nobody knows everything, but everybody knows something. Put a group together, and you experience far more than you could on your own.
What happens is we spark enthusiasm in each other. Somebody would come with a real interest in something, and you'd catch it. You know, you'd want to experience it too, because they had such a wonderful time with it.
You need to do a little preparation for a literary tour. Usually, you'll be provided with an itinerary and a reading list, two items Mary says you'll want to make good use of before you go.
I would recommend that they find out what the reading list is, not read all of it, but read the ones that interest them, so that they have that background. I always made sure I read something if we were going to meet the author, because I wanted to know, have that when they were talking to us. And I just advise them to do that, to get a map, to plot the trip on the map so they know geographically where they're going, and then to sit back and enjoy the ride.
Literary tours are usually held over the summer, when professors are free to travel. If you're looking for something different to do next summer, a literary tour might be, as Mary said, right up your alley. These days, there's sure to be one that covers your interests.
Well, I would encourage people, if they've got a passion, something they're really interested in, to look for tours in that area. I know that Sierra Club has some, and different universities and community colleges have them. You pretty much can trust the things that the schools put on. So I would just encourage people, if there is something they have a longing to see, to look for a tour that will fulfill that for them.
Mary says you'll enjoy yourself even more if you expect the unexpected. You never know what kind of adventure you'll have and what kind of memories you'll bring back to your reading.
We went to Haworth a couple of times, which is where the Brontes are from. And I went back after one of the tour with a roommate, because we'd already been to the area, we knew it, but then I got to walk the moors right where they'd been. I got to see the place where Wuthering Heights was based on. And those are really simple but exciting things.
Mary Whitson is a former elementary school teacher and literature fan. If you want to find out more about the tour she takes every year, I've put the organizer's email in the show notes. If you do join Mary, remember that she'll expect you to do your reading, or you'll have to sit in the naughty corner. In episode 3, Christine Cox, the house manager of the Amundsen Theater in Los Angeles, joined us with advice for performing your role as a good theater goer. Today, Christine is back with tips on bringing young children to the theater.
In my opinion, a young child should be of the age that of a school age. If they've started kindergarten, they're 5 or 6, they're going to understand a shush, or let's, you know, it's time now to be quiet. They're going to be able to sit through an hour. I find it sad when a parent wants to bring a 2 to 3 year old to Shakespeare and say, oh, but he loves it. He loves it. I think we're setting them up to fail. I want to start a child early in theater, but take them to children's theater that's geared towards their age so that they can be successful at watching and enjoying a show. So many young ones come, to Mary Poppins. That was a pretty dark Mary Poppins, and we allowed every age into that because it was a Disney affiliated. And then those 2-year-olds, I probably had more of them out in the lobby crying than I did having them watching it inside the seating area. So I think the parent needs to do a little research, because not every show, just because it says Mary Poppins, is going to look like the movie. And understand that your child is still of the video age, in my opinion. They can sit through a half hour at home, let's say, but it's very difficult to sit next to strangers for over an hour and be respectful of the people next to you while still trying to pay attention to the show.
And if the show is based on a book, Christine thinks reading the book together will help your child or grandchild pay attention.
I do think that's helpful. Requirement, probably not. But I think to help the child be successful in understanding the show, why not?
But your child or grandchild isn't the only one who needs a little preparation. You do too.
Please make sure they have a ticket. So even if you say, oh, but she's just going to sit on my lap, still needs to have the ticket next to you. And if you choose to pick them up and put them on your lap, that's fine. So there's a part of me is like, would I really want to pay over $100 for my two-year-old? And I say no. I say try to be respectful of the age of the child.
Christine Cox has been the house manager at the Amundsen Theater in Los Angeles for 16 years. If you missed her advice on theater going in episode 3, I've put a link to it in the show notes. With A Man from U.N.C.L.E. feature film hitting theaters in a few weeks, I've asked WBZ Boston talk show host and extreme U.N.C.L.E. fan Morgan White Jr. to remind us about some of the qualities that made The Real Man from U.N.C.L.E. stand out in a field of 1960s spy shows. Qualities I suspect Hollywood will miss in its updated version. However, I need to tell you, Morgan is more than an extreme U.N.C.L.E. fan.
I have a very, very good memory.
He's being humble. Morgan's memory is beyond very good and has been since third grade when he found he could remember television shows. No, really remember television shows. He could recite lines, passages, even whole scenes from shows 6 months after he first saw them.
And that's when I realized, quote unquote, I was a little different than the other kids.
Morgan has turned that difference into a nightclub act where he entertains audiences with his ability to pull up details on almost any topic. Not that he needed to prove it to me on my own show, but he asked for my favorite TV program. I decided to throw him a long ball and picked Howdy Doody.
You want to go Howdy Doody? I'll go Howdy Doody. Name his two siblings.
He had siblings?
Heidi Doody, his sister, and Double Doody, his brother.
Morgan's right. I looked it up. But he didn't have to.
But see, that's what I do. When I do trivia, I do it on all subjects so that people pick whatever subject they feel comfortable, and I just fly through it.
I decided I'd be more comfortable talking about The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Typical Friday night in America, you went out, you went to the bowling alley or did whatever activity held the attention of you and your family, but you made sure you were home by 10, because that's when The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was on. And very few TV programs gripped the viewing public the way The Man from U.N.C.L.E. did.
I don't have Morgan's memory, but that's the way I remembered The Man from U.N.C.L.E. too. What I was curious about was why it had that hold on us, and still does today.
It captured the American psyche for spies and espionage and these people who almost single-handedly, or in their case, the two of them, stood up against the world of the bad guys. You know, whether you talk Specter with Bond, or you talk Thrush with U.N.C.L.E., you talk Chaos with Get Smart. Everybody in those days was into that.
Not only were viewers into spy shows, the networks were too. Spy shows were the dominant form of drama in the 60s. Yet despite all the competition, U.N.C.L.E. stood out.
They knew right where their niche was. The phrase tongue-in-cheek explains U.N.C.L.E. perfectly. They didn't go hard drama until the fourth season. Fourth season, they did turn towards seriousness, left the campy aspect alone. But season 2 and 3, they were swimming in the murky waters of campiness, tongue-in-cheek, not too, too serious.
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was the show that bridged the gap between a Mission Impossible on one side and a Get Smart on the other. But what producer Norman Felton and writer-creator Sam Rolfe did better than anyone else at the time was make us believe it was all real.
You believe that there was a Napoleon Solo and an Ilya Kuryakin going out there and saving the world from Thrush every Friday. You believed that. But the little explanation at the end that was written, at the end of the credits, we wish to thank the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement for their cooperation and helping us put this TV show together. Without them, it would not have happened. I paraphrased it at the end. You know, when you watch the end of The FBI with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., we wish to thank the FBI for their help in putting this show together. You saw that same sort of standard statement for the end of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. So you thought there really was an agency out there called U.N.C.L.E. A lot of people wrote in, where do I address a letter to U.N.C.L.E.? When I grow up, I want to be an agent.
People wrote in to be U.N.C.L.E. agents? Who would do that? Anyway, one of the fun parts of watching The Man from U.N.C.L.E. today is the parade of stars who were featured on the show before they were stars. I tossed Morgan the name of one episode to see what he remembered. The Project Strigas affair.
Yes, Spock and Kirk.
He got it. Project Strigas paired William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy before Gene Roddenberry did it on Star Trek.
I like the fact that William Shatner, in a way, it was almost like a Captain Kirk characterization he was doing before he even got the role as Captain Kirk, with just pretending to be someone he's not, to fool the bad guys. It's almost like the Gambit episode on Star Trek. Leonard Nimoy was cool and detached. Gee, where have we seen him do that before? That episode was up one of the black and white episodes, which would have been the first season, which was 64-65, the first season. And Star Trek started in, if I'm not mistaken, 66. So it wasn't that far removed.
With everything it had going for it, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. lasted only 3.5 seasons.
The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. helped kill The Man from U.N.C.L.E. because now you split the attention of your audience. And had there been no Girl from U.N.C.L.E., I think The Man from U.N.C.L.E. would have hit season 4 all the way through and to season 5.
I couldn't let Morgan go without asking him the question that's haunted me for decades.
The technological hierarchy, TH, for the removal of undesirables and the subjugation of humanity. It was mentioned once. It's just one of those things. You could wake me up out of a sound sleep and say, Morgan, what did Thrush stand for? And I could tell you.
Morgan White Jr. is a trivia master extraordinaire, a talk show host, and perhaps an even bigger fan of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. than I am. If you'd like more information on his personal appearances, or if you'd like to book Morgan to entertain your group or organization, you'll find a link to his website in the show notes. There's also a story about David McCallum and how Ilya Kuryakin haunted him on NCIS. You can listen to Morgan Saturday nights on WBZ. I've put instructions on how to do that in the show notes as well. I told Mr. Waverly never to call me here. I'm sorry, I have to take this. So that will have to do it for episode 4 of Out of My Mind. Thank you for being a part of the program. And remember, the show works both ways. If you have a comment or suggestion, you can reach me by going to bit.ly/OOMM123 and clicking on episode 4. There you'll find several ways to share your thoughts. I'll have a new show for you next Saturday at 8 a.m. Eastern. Let's plan on talking then. I'm Jay Douglas. Out of My Mind is produced by Penny Summers and is a production of the Theater of Your Mind, Incorporated, Hollywood, California.